Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One. Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we got commentator James Lindsay, very interesting guy, is going to be on in the second half. News coming as well. First, I'll tell you about LifeLock, people. That's right. The pandemic has led to a huge increase in unemployment claims. Sadly, con artists have filed tens of thousands of fraudulent claims using consumers' identities. These are bad guys. They're trying to hack. Look, they know what you're doing. You're at home. You're doing all your shopping online. God knows the holiday season's coming soon. Who's going to a store? Everyone's shopping online. And now your info's out there and they're going to steal. They're going to steal it. The FTC has moved identity theft to the number one spot in fraud for America. You need to protect yourself, and that's where LifeLock kicks in. Go with the industry standard. Go with the best. Go with what we all use here. Go with LifeLock. Right, Dawson?
No one prevents all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LifeLock or head to LifeLock.com and use promo code Adam for 25% off.
Adam Carolla's I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, navigating our all-woke, no-joke culture, has over 1,000 five-star reviews on Amazon. Here's one.
I no longer feel alone in my thought. I will begin to question my sanity until read the book, comforting to know there are many the as you will see for that they are.
Thanks, Ozzy. Pick up I'm Your Emotional Support Animal now. Available in all formats. For more, go to AdamCarolla.com.
We have Dr. James Lindsay on the Zoom, author, mathematician, political commentator. The book, Cynical Theories, How Activists, Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why That Harms Everybody. Just the person I'd like to talk to. Good to talk to you, Doctor.
Yeah, good to be here, man.
So let's explain how that harms everybody when you make everything. For instance, I think a lot of people feel like, well, if you make everything about race, maybe that harms the red-haired, blue-eyed guy, but it would help the African-American person, wouldn't it?
Doesn't seem to be working out that way, does it?
No.
So we saw over the summer, we saw this idea like whiteness is property. So now we're making property be about race. And so then there were all these riots and people looted and they tore down buildings and burned down buildings. And we find out that this is disproportionately harmed black neighborhoods. So it doesn't seem to be working out quite that way. And that's just one example.
Well, my feeling is, look, so much harm is done in the name of good. And first things first, just fundamentally starting a whole bunch of different groups, you know, African Americans, Armenian Americans, I'm a Hispanic American. I don't like all the categorizing just in general, number one. But number two, taking a group and basically beating them over the head, explaining that we have systemic racism and they're never going to get along. And the reason they can't get ahead is not through their own effort, but moreover, the color of their skin. You cannot help that group that way, even if elements of that are true.
I agree. I actually had a really interesting conversation yesterday with a man who is from the Middle East originally. He's not an American, however, he's in Britain. So I guess he's a Middle Eastern British person. And he said that one of the first things that he had to endure when he came into that culture was to sit down, the British culture was to be sat down and have it explained to him that he's a person of color. And this he had no idea. And then he said in his exact words, "I thought I was just like everybody else." And then I ran into a statistic the other day saying that something like, you know, we talk about Hispanic Americans or Latinos, that something like less than one in four identify themselves as people of color or resonate with that term or think it applies to them. And so you have this kind of managerial class almost that seems to be trying to explain to people that they're disadvantaged and that they need to kind of work the system because they're disadvantaged. And it requires actually teaching them to think about themselves and the people that they know this way. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't seem productive.
Well, also, I always sort of think, like, what is the best parenting to someone who does have an actual handicap? And the best parenting is convince them they don't have a handicap and that they can do anything. They may have to outwork some other people, but they're going to get it done. And the next thing you do with that handicapped child is you try to convince them that they're not different. That's always what they say. Like, you're not handicapped. You're like any other kid in the school. You can do anything anyone can do, because you would be harming them if you're convincing them they were different, handicapped, and different. So if we take a group or any group and we keep trying to convince them that they're different, they're different, they don't fit in here. I mean, just forget about Black or Hispanic. Let's just picture a handicapped kid in the fifth grade. Do you know how much harm you would do to that kid if you just kept convincing him? Nobody wants you here at Colfax Elementary because you're different. This notion, when we get into this thing, the thing that fucking rips my shit apart, the thing that makes me so angry is when politicians go, people are scared of people because they don't look like them. They're scared of people who look different than them. That is such a load of shit in this country in 2020. Are you fucking high? Everyone looks different than everyone else, especially in Los Angeles. To say that I'm scared of someone because they don't look like me is insanely insulting, condescending, and doesn't help everyone who doesn't look like me, although they're lucky they don't look like me.
I 100% agree. You know, I hear all the time. Now, you speak of the kids in the schools. I hear all the time from parents who are having to deal with, as the schools are kind of going back, and maybe not in California. I don't know what you guys are doing with the lockdowns. I hear it's bad there. But the schools are kind of going back. They're dealing with their kids going back. And, you know, basically every school in the universe took up this woke bullcrap over the summer and has to make everything be about race. And so now, you know, you have exactly the thing that you were talking about. You know, the school coming down with a separating kids sometimes even by race, saying, oh, the white kids have to go in this class, all the other kids have to go in these other classes, and then explaining to them these ideas of privilege, these ideas of systemic racism. And the school has always been systemically racist. The school system, the whole society doesn't really value you the same, is a message that keeps getting repeated to these kids that I guess we would call brown and black or whatever. These non-white kids are getting taught that the school system doesn't want them there. And it blows my mind. You say, you know, it enrages you, it enrages me that we're in a position now where this has become standard practice in our schools. I mean, I thought the point of our schools is that we're trusting other competent professional adults with the education and care of our children for however many hours per day, not to tell them horrible things like this, or if they're white, to tell them, oh, well, your privilege means that you're holding down these other people. And that I heard a story, this lady told me that her I think 7-year-old son gets in the car despondent. I think a little white boy gets in the car despondent after school one day last spring. I heard this story, and says she's all bummed out, and what's wrong, buddy? You know, the whole conversation. She says, well, I'm the worst kind of person. And she says, what do you mean? He's like, well, I'm white. I'm the worst kind of person. And it's just, it's child abuse to do that to kids, well, either side of the coin.
It's a two-way street of child abuse. Telling the 7-year-old white kid, it's basically your kind that has caused all this pain and anguish and death, that's child abuse. Telling the young Hispanic or Black kid, you can't get along in this society because this society doesn't value you or want you in it, is child abuse. It's a fucking two-way street of child abuse that's put on by a bunch of fucking woke people that I don't know if they think they're doing good or they're just fucking virtue signaling. There's no data that suggests any of this has done anyone any good, and we've been doing it for a while. And their plan is, well, yeah, we have nothing to suggest this helps Black people. We need to ratchet it up. Okay, so you've been going in the wrong direction for 50 years, and now you want to go faster in the wrong direction? Right. That doesn't make sense to me, but, you know, I didn't go to college, so what the fuck do I know?
I went to college forever. It doesn't make sense to me either. Don't worry.
What?
The doctor's example of, your example of the of separating kids by race and giving them different lectures, that's outrageous. Where and when is this happening?
You know, I don't think that they're doing the full out segregating in a whole lot of schools, but I get unbelievable numbers of emails from people telling me what's going on either in their workplace or in their school or whatever. And so I've heard from a number of school districts, and these would include elementary schools, they would include high schools, where they're actually separating people and they have them do these privilege exercises. You know, how privileged are you? Everybody gets kind of uncomfortable and humiliated. Then they have these kind of separated situations where they teach people different things in different ways. Then try to bring them back together to confront one another, I suppose. And I guess the answer is, I couldn't name a specific one, but schools across America and probably some non-trivial percentage of them are fiddling with this right now, because this is exactly what the doctrines and their theory, which is filtered into educational theory, teaches.
Well, also, I guess the question kind of is, if you just break it down with the schools, and you have to think about, because there's all kinds of fucking wacky shit coming on. I mean, we're in California, so they're starting to pass a lot of things that have to do with the curriculum that a lot of parents disagree with. And I don't think you need to be a Hasidic Jew or born again Christian to disagree with this, a lot of the stuff they're teaching. But here's just an overarching question. How much of this should they be teaching at school? I mean, I would like my kid to learn to read and write and do long division and state capitals and shit like that. But when it comes to sort of values, how about I teach them those values? What percentage of the school's time should be eaten up with these sort of moral values, societal, whatever, morality plays? Like, why? Why is any of it? Well, you know, I mean, take a civics class. Fine. But I mean, shouldn't we just be doing kind of history and math and English? Why is it even their job to pick up that mantle?
Right. I would agree with you that that's their job. But the theory that these activists are working from, and when I say activists, I mean activists who have become teachers, activists who have become school administrators. The theory says that the cultural values and the power dynamics associated with those and the injustices are already baked into the system, so that you have to teach it explicitly, or else you're teaching it through what they call the hidden curriculum. So they say it's already being taught one way or the other, so they need to make it explicit, and then they need to make it right. So they're convincing themselves that there's a moral imperative to teach these values in our schools and to rearrange all of our subjects. You know, you mentioned history, you mentioned long division. I actually saw a thing yesterday from a math program that, you know, it's a PowerPoint or whatever, and it's talking about the Pythagorean theorem. You know, you have a right triangle, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, the whole thing. And it says, it shows the Pythagorean theorem, it shows some graphics of some triangles like you might expect, and it says questions for discussion, A, B, and C, and the questions are something like, who came up with this? Why would they name it after this person? It's all these kind of sociological questions. And let's talk about, why do we name it after Pythagoras instead of naming it after a Chinese person who came up with a similar idea? Or why not instead of a Sumerian, or, you know, something like this? And so they're actually trying to put the values into a sociological context and turn all of the subjects into a sociology class. And the reason really is that that's all they know, as often happens, but also because they believe that there is a moral imperative to study society and human sociological things in order to change society, which we, you know, can draw back to a famous German thinker from the mid-19th century.
Ryan, you had a question?
Yeah, follow up on that, because so I had my eyes open a little bit. It's not the exact same thing, but it's similar to what you're talking about. You're a mathematician. You probably know more about 10 times more about this than I do, but I think it was one of Malcolm Gladwell's books, and I think it was about how Chinese people are so much better at math than American white kids because they learn it differently. And so I guess my question is, the Pythagorean theorem thing versus the Chinese thing is sociological. Does that belong in a different setting, or does that not belong anywhere? Because obviously in a math class, it's just about finding the answer, right? Like, who cares about the sociology of it? But does that have a place anywhere, or is that off the table, I guess, is my question.
So I'm actually a fairly big proponent of not necessarily like wild experimental methodologies. There's been a lot of these for like teaching math. There's been a lot of these criticisms levied at Common Core education, for example, where people have showed the multiplication method that they teach, and it looks like it's very slow, and it looks like it's very confusing, and the parents don't understand it. And it's not the method of multiplication most of us learned if we're
but
over,
the kids,
you know,
get it
30.
Right away, right?
Well, this is the thing. It's actually a very intuitive way. So there are reasons to attack Common Core or to criticize Common Core. That turns out not to be one of them. And so learning in a different way is one thing, but then hijacking the conversation or hijacking the subject to teach a different subject entirely is a different kind of problem. So when you turn your math class into story time instead of learning to do math, and the stories are all about power dynamics and how certain people, the question that often gets shoehorned in, and this is explicit in Seattle's ethnic studies mathematics program, is who does it benefit for that to be the right answer? Or who does it benefit for us to say that's who gets to decide what the right answer is? This who does it benefit, this idea of this cynical analysis that somebody has set the system up to benefit politically off of it, even with things like arithmetic, that's a different thing to be teaching than, you know, oh, well, here's one way you can do multiplication or think of multiplication. Here's another way that may be more intuitive. It may be less algorithmic or maybe more algorithmic. You know, I have a lot of belief in room for experimenting between different methodologies and how intuitive they are, as long as they are rigorous mathematical methodologies. It's a different thing entirely to turn it into a power dynamic story hour.
I concur. There's a TV commercial that Gary saw here, Young Money, Cash Money, Gary.
That's right.
He found a commercial, kind of a PSA, ABC. This was running during the football game, Monday night or Tuesday night. I can't recall. It could have been Sunday night, but it was local, ABC local. And this is kind of part and parcel of where we're at now, because I'm seeing a lot of these kinds of commercials and PSAs. Here we go.
You see the face of a stranger. In the blink of an eye, your mind is made up. That's facism. Those quick, unfair judgments.
All right, hold on. We don't have any video. We'll reboot it. You gotta put the vid up.
But we're gonna learn about facism.
We're gonna learn about
even
facism.
The words are already telling me something. Facism.
Jesus
we're gonna
Christ.
Get into our implicit and unconscious biases.
It's okay. We'll just play the audio. Go ahead.
I'll go back 15 seconds.
Start from the beginning.
So it's right after this commercial. So.
Okay.
Here we go.
I've always had a...
You see the face of a stranger. In the blink of an eye, your mind is made up. That's facism. Those quick, unfair judgments. Now our mission, to bring people together, because there's more behind the face. Our special series, Facism, at 5, here on ABC 7.
They're going to do a face... they're going to do a series. Number one, they go those... Yes.
No, wasn't there another Malcolm Gladwell book about this called Blink? Like, you make the 10,000 assumptions in the split second or whatever it is?
It's funny. They always go, those quick and unfair assumptions. Like, well, how about when you see a hot chick or dude with a cleft in his chin who go, that guy looks smart. You know what I mean? Like, I do that stuff all the time. First things first. We're human beings. We're animals. We really are. We learn a lot from a person's face. You learn, I mean, first... I always used to say this when I used to do Loveline. I could hear a lot in everyone's voice, you know. But don't you think if I said I'm going to line up a gay man and a racist, don't you think you could look at that person's face and sort of make a decision? You may not be right, but I'm saying I think I'd be right about 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, I like my chances the majority of the time.
Yes, yeah, but now there's facism. But you see, we're getting to the point where we're asking ourselves to do things that are almost biologically impossible.
Right, and you're being morally judged when you can't. That's never a good sign. I mean, that's the realm of totalitarianism. I mean, that's getting into your head. It's talking about looking at your level, your reactions at the level of intuitions, at the level of instantaneous, connections that your brain makes, and then saying, whoops, you are a bad person because that happened, rather than, maybe you made that snap decision in your head, and then you were like, wait a minute, if I acted on that, it would make me an asshole. So I'm not going to act on that, and I'm going to go talk to the people and find out who they are behind their face first. So you are completely correct that we're now getting to the point where it is becoming fundamentally unnatural, almost like we're supposed to be, robots that think in the way that we're programmed to think about. I think about this a lot with racism. You know, everybody's like, oh, confess your racism from this woke perspective. And it's like, I thought we just spent 50 years telling people to shut up if they're racist and keep it to themselves.
Right.
Do we really want? And again, I hear from people all the time, and I hear these like struggle sessions people have at work. So this Indian Canadian woman emails me, and she's like, hey, so we had a brown fragility training at my work, and here's what happened. They had to have all the people sit down in the room that are lighter skinned than us or white or what they called white adjacent and explain to us how they're racist. And so now I work with all my coworkers, and I didn't think any of them were racist, and now they're all telling me that they're racist, and I'm super uncomfortable. And so then we're supposed to interrogate our feelings of defensiveness, they say, about this, and it, everything just gets even more uncomfortable. So this is the kind of, you know, you said that there's no evidence that this helps anybody a minute ago. There's evidence that this hurts people, and they're still like, well, more pedal to the metal, because their interpretation is anything that goes wrong is the fault of hidden white supremacy within the system. And so it's just like, you know, it's like having a fever to get rid of a disease that you have. It's a reaction. And this is, I don't know what else to say except that it's insane. And you couldn't possibly be more backwards with what's going on.
Also, how would you like to work with a bunch of people if you were a different color, a different ethnicity, and they basically just went, sorry, I'm racist. Like, oh, yeah. It must be wonderful. I'll see you Monday. You want me to bring the donuts?
That's this is a toxic awesome. Work environment.
It does. That's exactly right. It creates toxic and hostile working environments. And if you think the brown fragility one is disgusting, a gay man sent me one, actually a gay trans man sends me this note talking about what happened with his sensitivity training. And he's like, for every day after it happened, for like a month, everybody's coming up to my office and like asking me weird questions like, so, you know, how do you do it? You know, like weird prying sex life questions. And he's like, I got along with everybody before this happened. And then we had a sensitivity training and he had to quit his job. Over that because he got so bothered by people. And like, I was at this thing a few weeks ago. I went and this lady comes up to me and she says, you know, she's of, I don't know, I guess, I don't know what ethnicity she is, but her skin tone was darker than mine at any rate. And she says, how do I get my white friends to stop apologizing to me like every day? How do I do it? That's like, I don't know.
Do we even know? Sorry for sounding like Roseanne Barr, but in this day and age, like Kamala Harris and many, many of these other women, especially at some point when they cross the age of 50 and they start doing their hair a certain way or something. I don't know what their heritage is. I really don't. I don't know who's a person or who's African American versus Indian descent. Like I'm trying to think of,
well, Kamala's both.
Yeah, she's both. And of course I know that because you hear about it all the time, but, when Roseanne Barr went off on Susan Jared.
Valerie Jarrett.
You look at Valerie Jarrett, she looks, reminds me of one of my mom's friends when I was a kid. Like, I wouldn't know that she was a black person. But on the other hand, by the way, if you told me she's black, I'd go, okay. And if you said she's Pakistani, I'd go, okay. And then you'd go, she's from Iraq. I'd go, okay. I'm not... That's what I think. I don't even need to know any of that stuff. It's just, it's a person. And in this modern America, there's so many people just when you go out. Again, I live in Los Angeles, so I see a lot more of this, but there's just a lot of people where it's like, I don't know what you are or if you're mixed or who cares.
It's
a bizarre thing to focus on. I have but it's also a kind of a control of the language. Now, which we have a clip of Senator Mazie Hirono is sort of explaining this whole new thing that you can't say sexual preference anymore. and Merriam-Webster defined it in the dictionary. They changed it the next day, which is now we're getting into some weird Orwellian world where we're telling everyone how to look at people, how not to look at people, and then what words to choose to describe interactions or traits. Here we go.
You use the term sexual preference to describe those in the LGBTQ community. And let me make clear, sexual preference is an offensive and outdated term. It is used by anti-LGBTQ activists to suggest that sexual orientation is a choice. It is not. Sexual orientation is a key part of a person's identity.
All right, so we're all fucking gay bashers, I guess. I've always said sexual preference. I thought sexual preference was evolved. I didn't know it was a way to bash the community.
Not anymore, unfortunately. Okay. Actually, within the literature, people of color, they're now trying to say that people of color has a term that was invented by white people just to signify that they're not white and group them all and ignore the differences from one race to another within the non-white races. These people are literally, I don't know a better way to put it, they're literally insane in the sense of having like an obsession at focusing upon like the most grotesque minutia about race and how that translates into power dynamics that they can then, you know, try to leverage to, as we just saw there, sound smart. And credit to the judge, right, for not rolling her eyes. Was there ever a better effort given?
Well, here's my deal. Here's my take on this entire breadth and width of everything we've been talking about. If all the no, you can't use this term, and it's Latinx now, and you can no longer say sexual preference, and we're going to teach you that the United States was founded in 1619 or whatever it is. If it all wasn't being used as a cudgel to beat everyone off, I mean, to fuck everyone up, then I'd say fine. You believe that, you talk that way, I'll talk this way. But it all translates into you're racist, you're homophobic, you're attacking indigenous people, whatever it is. So it's not just we have a difference of opinion. It's not just you use this word, you know. So I say Negro and you say African-American. If you said, well, that's OK, I use African-American, you use Negro, I'm going to go my separate way. Fine. But now I'm a racist or I'm homophobic or I'm not respecting the indigenous people's group. It always ends up going down this lane where you've invented something that's 10 minutes old. I didn't learn it fast enough for you. And now I need to be taken out to the woodshed. That's the part that scares me. Have a difference of opinion. Fine. Don't have it translate into me being punished.
No. That's the whole point, too, though. Right. It's really an application of power. That's not just, oh, you're a racist or you're a homophobe or whatever. It's you're a racist, you're a homophobe, whatever. So shut up and listen. In other words, give me the keys to the castle and I'm going to be your new master now. And that's exactly how it works. And we shouldn't get confused that this is like, oh, you know, it's white people, it's black people, it's this, it's that. No, Kanye West put a MAGA hat on when said, I think for myself, you know, and the next, 2 days later, you had Ta-Nehisi Coates writing in the Atlantic and say, Kanye is no longer black. Like, he's out. You had the lady from the 1619 Project put on Twitter, you know, well, there's a difference between politically black and racially black. And so this is really about a set of activists who are using race as a tool to give themselves the power to make other people shut up and look bad. And so you saw that with the judge just there. This was an application of, listen, you transgress some boundary that we more or less made up. And then you can look, you know, prominent Democrats, prominent whoever you want, use sexual preference, you know, probably within the last few months, completely with no problem. And so they make up this rule. And then, like you said, the really scary part now is you got other institutions. You got Merriam-Webster saying, you know, we're on that, you know, some 24-year-old intern or whatever is in there changing the definition of preference. I looked down there, 1, 2, 3, 4, then 5, offensive. That's what it says, offensive.
Well, I'll talk to you in a more complete fashion on Take a Knee, which is going to air November 2nd. Let me give you some plugs. Cynical Theories is the name of the book. It's available now on Amazon. And also the website, newdiscourses.com, is where you can go as well. Dr. James Lindsay, thanks for all the food for a thought, my friend.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll talk soon. All right. I'll hit Red Cap and then we'll roll into the news. Gina Grad.
Let's do it.
Comfort done right. Making workwear and uniforms since 1923 for the essential workers, making our community strive. Clothing for many industries, automotive, culinary, manufacturing, waste management, oil block, coveralls, resist engine fluids, Oil just beads up and rolls off. Latest projects is for the road heroes. You know about these guys, the truckers, the trucker tab. A $50,000 tab at Cracker Barrel to feed our long haulers, and check out the truckertab.com. And yeah, you know, I never thought about it until we were talking to Sheree. Yesterday, which is like, yeah, truckers can't just go eat anywhere because they're driving an 18-wheeler.
No drive-thrus.
No drive-thrus, and no, you couldn't eat anywhere in my neighborhood if you had an 18-wheeler, had to park an 18-wheeler. So we got to help these guys out. Give a donation. Go to truckertab.com and truckertab.com. Redcap, work where done right. All right, quick break. We'll come back with the news and Bald and Gina right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gina Grad. Breaking viral. All those crazy Trump tweets. Give me news with Gina Grad. Trouble in the Middle East. Celebrity drunk meltdowns. Deep news with Gina. Gina Grad.
The news with Gina Grad.
So this is sort of an interesting take on how COVID is being dealt with in Germany. The organization that negotiates compensation with the German government has agreed to provide more than €500 million, about $662 million, to aid Holocaust survivors struggling under the burdens of this pandemic. This is according to the New York Post. So the payment will be going to approximately 240,000 survivors around the world, Israel, North America, and former Soviet Union, Western Europe, primarily over the next 2 years. Why is that?
I would say if you're a Holocaust survivor, you're in a high risk category.
You have a lot of, yeah.
Well, not only the Holocaust, but that ended in 1945, right?
You're of a certain age.
You're of a certain age.
Correct. And so the reason they're doing this is the thinking is with the end of World War II, now 75 years in the past. And again, with 240,000 people, I mean, it seems like a lot, but also not a lot if that's who's left from, you know, that time period. They were deprived of proper nutrition when they were young, so they're suffering from numerous medical issues. In addition, many lived isolated lives, having lost their entire families in the Holocaust, and also have psychological issues because of the persecution under the Nazis. So that's how they're throwing money at the problem that way.
Wow. I don't know. Maybe this is me being crass, but come on, Holocaust survivors. Rub some dirt on it. Let's go. Suck it up. Walk it off. Let's get on with it.
If you're still alive from the Holocaust, you've done enough sucking it up in the first 3 years of your life that you are done sucking it up.
Are you hurt or are you injured?
Oh, boy.
Helmet's not a chair. All right, let's go. Grab a knee. Here we go.
That's right. More grit.
More grit.
Well, speaking of World War II, I just really wanted to show you this video. A huge bomb dropped by Britain during World War II has exploded after being discovered in a canal in Poland, according to CNN. It's called the Tall Boy. It weighed 12,000 pounds when it was dropped by the Royal Air Force during the final months of the war. The bomb is the biggest ever found in Poland and is believed to have been used in a raid on the German ship Lutzo. Lutzow. The Polish Navy attempted to defuse it Tuesday. It's called deflagration. Am I saying that right?
Polish Navy sounds like a setup.
Oh, it does.
Mm-hmm. A method that involves heating an explosive until it burns rather than detonate it. But the bomb exploded in the canal, sending up this huge plume.
Dr. Nick Riviera. Who knew flammable and inflammable meant the same thing?
Wow. So
there we go. We're seeing the explosion. The operation to remove the bomb began last Monday when the Navy began moving residents and sending everybody out of the area to evacuate.
You know, the... Yeah, the Polish Navy sounds like something like when your, you know, 11-year-old son and his Little League team would come bounding into the house, that the chain-smoking mom would go, oh, great, here comes the Polish Navy. I'll make sandwiches, number one. Number two, World War II sort of ended an era of kooky experimental weapons. So we now... Our weapons, you know, China's got weapons, Soviet has weapons, we have weapons. And there's some interesting technology going on, but they're not kooky. You know what I mean? They had kooky stuff. I mean, they had giant cannons. I think the Germans had a giant cannon on like railroad tracks, and it thing was like 150 feet high and would launch a 3,000 pound shell 70 miles. Like, they came up with kooky shit back then, and it was all kind of like, well, if a cannon that's 10 feet long is good, well, then a cannon that's 100 feet long will be even better. But it wasn't. Jesus. I mean, it's literally a giant cannon. I mean, I don't know what that thing weighed. I don't know. It was like...
It's pictured, it was an animation or illustration. It's pictured next to a tank. It dwarfs the tank.
Oh, yeah. It's like a building.
It's giant. You couldn't imagine how much engineering would and man hours would be in something like that. They roll it on train tracks. You know, they had buzz bombs, and you know, they had these they had rockets, essentially unmanned, unpiloted stuff. There were just these buzz bombs and stuff. I've told you guys that Japan thought they were going to drop these incendiary bombs on the Northwest here and burn, have huge forest fires everywhere. Turns out Gavin Newsom beat them to the punch. No, but they did kooky ass shit because they couldn't really work anything out. You think, you know what it's like? It was like Evel Knievel jumps versus Travis Pastrana jumps. Travis Pastrana will tell you they will work everything out in the computer. Like, they will.
Oh, yeah.
I'll give you just a very stupid example, but think about it. Modern day guys like Travis Pastrana, whoever, when they're jumping 200, 300 feet, the ramp is progressive. It goes flat and then it starts to curve up and then it gets to its angle. Evel would just like hold a playing card down on the ground. So, of course, he'd hit his ramp, his suspension would bottom out, and he'd be fucking out of shape as he launched because they couldn't figure out this sort of progressive curve where the ramp actually met the terra firma. So they're able to work out weights and distance. Anyway, these guys were all analog, and they didn't really have many simulations or computers or whatever it is. So they had to like do everything to find out it didn't work. So they came up with tons of just kooky ass shit, and most of it didn't work. But we would probably work it out in the simulator before we actually built it now. Sorry, how big was that thing, or what was its plan?
It was called the Schwerer Gustav, which means heavy Gustav in English. It is 1,350 tons. Its length is 155 feet. And, yeah, I'm still reading more about it. I just found
out. How far was it supposed to launch a shell? And they used it a couple of times. Germany had lots of weird shit at the end of the war that they really didn't get a chance to use, like the first jet airplanes and stuff like that. I know. They worked so hard, and then, man, someone pulls the plug on the genocide.
Sad.
Stings. We've all been there. Yeah. All right, Gina, sorry. What else you got?
Some more sad news. Legendary New York comedy club Dangerfields has closed its doors. Rodney Dangerfield opened the club in 1969, hosted everybody. Seinfeld, Jim Carrey, Andrew Dice Clay, George Carlin, Chris Rock, the list goes on and on. On its website, the club's management announced with great sadness that after 50 years of continuous operations, we'll be closing our New York City venue effective immediately.
And of course, this
is all COVID-related.
What shall become of these comedy clubs? I've said it a million times. Neither fish nor fowl. They can't do outdoor dining. You know, we can't bring the barber's chair out to the sidewalk and cut you. It's just like they're just closed.
Well, here's what I don't understand, and maybe I'm missing something very obvious, so please tell me. If these businesses closing are all rent-based, like how can I afford, you know, $20,000 a month when we can't make revenue, then why are they still having to pay rent?
I don't know anything.
Wouldn't it solve everything if rent was put on hold for businesses?
It would, and then the problem is it's a
if you're not allowed to operate.
It's this Rubik's Cube that never really lines up, which is, well, we shouldn't allow them to have to pay rent. It's like, okay, well, then what about all the people who rely on the rent as their business.
We're dealing with that with residences. We're dealing with that right now. So why aren't we talking about that with businesses?
I think there's some of that. I don't know how it works. Then it's like, well, now let the federal government print some money and bail them out. And then we argue about that.
Or we just start over as a society because everything's closed and our kids are dumb.
I think that's what we're heading for. The gun could fire shells weighing 7 tons, 30 miles. So your Subaru, Gina, you're driving the Subaru, right?
Yep. Got that Crosstrek.
It's a Subaru Crosstrek Maxipata. Yeah, Crosstrek or Trek?
Trek. Like Star Trek.
Crosstrek.
That doesn't help, Gina.
I will bet you
Trek and field.
That thing does not weigh over 4,000 pounds, meaning that thing is not 2 tons. So the point is this gun could launch 7 of your cars, this gun could launch 3.5 of your cars from here to the Santa Monica Pier. That's what that gun could do. Oh, it's 3,200 pounds, right? There's 2,000 pounds in a ton. So we're talking about 4.5 of your cars plus.
Oofa.
Or 4. I'm right around 4, right? Well, Max about figure out. Anyway, that thing was big and expensive. And it was used the Germans near the end of the war to avoid capture.
It was destroyed by the Germans, yeah. So this is the largest caliber rifle weapon ever used and the heaviest mobile artillery piece ever built.
At some point, you got to destroy it because you don't want the Ruskies getting it.
How do you destroy that? It's not like you put it in the paper shredder.
I don't know, man. You got to get a running start if you want to destroy that thing.
Sticky bombs.
We call in the Polish Navy. They're the best of the best.
You tell them to fix it?
That's right. Let me hit BetterHelp here. Overwhelmed and anxious, depressed. I get it. So does BetterHelp. Online, licensed professional counselors who are trained to listen and help. Man, if you guys don't know, there's a lot going on in the psychological department these days, now more than ever. Man, you need to take control of that aspect of your life, and it'll improve every aspect of your life. That's what we're just talking about with Gina. Connect with your counselor in a safe and private online environment. Everything shared is confidential. Fill out a questionnaire to assess your needs and get matched in under 48 hours. Easily schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus exchange unlimited messages. For any reason you're unhappy, well, don't worry. You can request a new therapist to speak to anytime, no charge. BetterHelp, right, Dawson?
BetterHelp is a truly affordable option, and our listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code Corolla, so why not get started today? Go to BetterHelp.com/Corolla. That's BetterHelp.com/Corolla. Talk to a therapist online and get help.
All right. What else, Gina?
So we're talking about torture. Why don't we continue? 3 correction officers at a jail in Oklahoma who play the Baby Shark song for inmates have lost their jobs and are facing cruelty charges. 2 former officers and their supervisors are charged with conspiracy and cruelty to an inmate after they handcuffed 4 inmates to a wall and made them listen to the children's song on a loop. One of the accused officers copped to the punishment, saying they did it to discipline inmates and to teach them a lesson because they felt disciplinary action with the detention center was not working.
What did these guys do? Were they accused of doing something?
Unclear. Maybe just side-eyeing somebody, mean-mugging them.
Yeah,
they just felt that it was a little too lax at this center. They needed to teach these guys a lesson. You're all familiar with that song, right?
Yes.
Oh, it's Tessa's okay. Jam.
Yeah.
So it actually gets worse. Now, Brian, you guys are in a wonderful spot where you don't have to deal with this because they're older and younger. But since we have a little one in the house who is in Zoom kindergarten, check out the song that I hear every day. You got it, Dawson?
My baby?
Repeat after me.
Repeat after me.
Oh, a milkshake.
Oh, a milkshake.
A sticky, sticky waffle.
A sticky, sticky waffle.
A mozzarella pizza.
A mozzarella pizza.
All the eggs are broken.
All the eggs are broken.
That was really nothing.
That was really nothing.
We can do it British.
We can do it British.
Oh, a milkshake.
Oh, a milkshake.
A sticky, sticky waffle.
This is my morning every day.
A mozzarella
pizza. Is that educational value?
I think it's patience, maybe. Anger management.
Here's how this...
And it goes on forever. Oh,
I've never even heard this before.
It's new.
My kids' homeschooling could probably be just distilled down to this exchange, which is before I left for work today, I saw my daughter coming down the stairs from upstairs. She's doing her homeschooling in her room or room or Zoom or whatever it is. And she was like coming down the stairs. And I was like, oh, is this during your break? And she said, no. Nah. So she just got up and left. She didn't go out of town, but she got up and went upstairs to do something. And then I walked into my son's room. He was still in bed under his covers, just kind of half awake with the computer open on the bed. And he's like, yeah, I'm just doing it from here. And I'm like, of course. By the way, as I like to say, could it go any other way? It can't go any other way. I mean, I guess I could do some parenting or something. But
in a weird way, this is just occurring to me, so it's half-baked. In a weird way, this is kind of the manifestation of your desire, like, for kids. If they're curious, the cream will rise to the top, right? Like, if they have a natural curiosity, no amount of schooling is going to make a difference.
Are you calling his kids silt?
They're silt dish. Every person who I've ever spoken to that either had a professional degree in education or a doctorate, what I'm saying is almost every super intelligent person I've ever spoken to about this subject says, you're either curious or you're not. If you're curious, you'll go learn everything all the time in the world's your oyster. And if you're not, sort of God help you. That seems to be my opinion and almost everyone's opinion. We don't really talk about it out loud that often, but if you're curious, you'll be fine. Now, here's the question, I guess, because almost everyone is curious about some things, but the truly curious are curious about almost everything, right? And if, in fact, your kids are curious about almost everything, then they will be their own best professor. They would just go through life looking up things, reading things, observing things, trying to figure out how things work and so on and so forth. If they're only curious about, and you could pick a band or you could pick a team or you could pick a television show, then it's
their thing.
If it's just about their thing, like they like Friends and they like the Baltimore Ravens, although I doubt that human exists. But let's just say there's one person with that kind of range, but that's about it. And I think we all know those people, and we all sort of...
It's the majority of people, isn't it?
It is, and we kind of feel a little like they're a little bit dull around the knife edge, you know what I mean? Where they're just constantly talking about that project car that's in their garage that they never finish, you know what I mean? And the wife is obsessed with baking or something. No offense to Chrissy, but what I mean, it's like, that's her life. That's just it. Her life is in that kitchen talking about pastries. And I think what we all want is the Renaissance man, Renaissance woman, you know, going out, leading your life.
Stromer.
Now, yeah, like Stromer. My kids are smart, and my son is very curious. It's just whatever's going down at school, especially via Zoom, is like fucking Boringville to him. And also, they are letting these kids live in their natural habitat. When you go to school, so here's the deal. The kids aren't any different than the adults, right? So the adults would go into work. So what would you do? Well, the alarm goes off, you get up, you shave, you blow dry your hair, apply your makeup or your ointment or your product or whatever that is, get yourself dressed, you know, head out with your commuter mug. By the time you rolled into work, you were dressed. You'd been up for an hour, hour and a half. You'd done something aesthetically, sometimes even worked out or went to the Y or swam some laps, whatever that is. So with adults, we started saying to them, let's just have a Zoom meeting about 10-ish. You know what I mean? We can just do it from your own apartment. Well, what percentage of adults got up, shaved, showered, blow-dried their hair?
Half-dressed.
Yeah.
What? Yeah, who put pants on?
Right. People went full sweatpants and T-shirts and flip-flops, if that. And then what percentage of them started kind of muting and watching the TV, you know, behind the computer screen, or getting up and sneaking out, going to the kitchen, making some toast, you know, and running back. So it basically beckons our worst qualities. Mm-hmm. You know, when you tell someone you don't have to go anywhere in the morning, go find all the people who don't have to go anywhere in the morning, and I'll show you a bunch of people in sweatpants and the T-shirt they slept in. So now we're telling kids who are less mature, presumably, than the than the working adults, you don't have to go anywhere. Well, how long before they turn into my kids?
You know what it's like? It's why we're not supposed to feed the bears.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly why we don't feed bears at a park, you know, a national park. This is what it does to them.
Every single thing, Gina Grad, that is going on in our society goes right back to, here's why you can't feed the bears. You hurt the bears. The bears get fat. They don't learn to forage or hunt, and they end up hanging out by the dumpster. Mm-hmm. That's all you need to know about almost every facet of our civilization. And that's why if a politician says, we're going to feed the bear, I go, don't do it. Don't do it. You're hurting the bear. But I like the bear. I want to help the bear. No.
And if you're ever out of food or extra scraps, the bear's screwed.
Mm. Yes. Yes. And there's never going to be enough. And by the way, how long before the bear goes, these are Hydrox, not Oreos. What the fuck?
What gives?
What's up, folks?
Thought I was so safe taking the under on 18 and a half mentions of the word bear today. Here we are.
What's up, boo-boo? All right, let's bring it home.
Watch Bear Force One again. Oh, okay.
Oh, man.
Let's bring it home,
I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news.
Gina Grad! That was the news with Gina Grad.
Oh, we have my video of my old house and my new house by, is it Jorge?
It's probably Jorge Pena.
Jorge Pena. Here we go. Sorry.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team. Yeah, started from the bottom, now we're here.
There it is.
I love that.
Almost worked, yeah. I literally saw that when I got home yesterday, and I just went in, and I flipped my computer open, and I went to my daughter's room, and I sat down, and I said, this is a picture of the bathroom that was inside my house that I grew up in, and she kind of went, ugh. And I went, yeah. So there's just this bathroom. There wasn't another one.
This was the bathroom.
That was your bathroom?
This is the bathroom.
No,
now,
that was the bathroom.
She has a bathroom in her room that's 500,000 times nicer than that, with Carrera tile and everything. But right. But I sat there and I just said, this is how I grew up. This is the bathroom. This is the bathroom we all use. And it's the only bathroom. So sometimes when you hear my opinions about things, or sometimes when I have thoughts about things, it's coming from the perspective of a person who grew up here. This is how I grew up. And you think daddy's nuts, or where did he get this stuff? Understand, I grew up here. So I have a different perspective. I understand living here now. Which is awesome, but understand I'm coming from this perspective oftentimes, and that'll probably help you have a little bit of insight to many of the ways I think.
And you know what else? It gets me thinking, and no, I don't mean to pile on here, but like you hear like, well, they were poor, but they were proud. Mm. And, you know, like say like the Jewish ghettos and stuff. There was still, you know, lace doilies over the arm of the, you know, the armchair, but the room was as big as my studio. You know, so there is always, of course, a way to take pride in any space you have. I'm just not seeing it reflected in those pictures.
Probably not, Gina. Thanks for pointing that out.
Sorry.
No, it's true. I've told people all the time. It's sort of like this thing where it's like, oh, of course these people are stealing. They're poor. What do you want? There's a way to be poor with a lot of dignity. I mean, there is a way to take care of yourself. There's a way to take care of your parents. There's a way to take care. The curb appeal of your house, it's all labor. It's all labor. It's the fascia, the paint, the lawn, the garden. It's all effort, and there's no materials involved with it. It's really just all pride. All right, let's bring it home, Gina Grad.
I'm Gina Grad.
Oh, she did it?
News.
Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, where was I? Geico. Last but not least, Geico. Would you like to save a whole bunch of money on your auto insurance? Might I suggest Geico? You can save, get a quote, by the way, at geico.com. You can do it with automotive. You can do it with RV. You can do it with motorcycle insurance. It's all there at geico.com. So just hop on over to geico.com and find out just how much you could be saving. All right. West Palm Beach, Florida Improv, November 20th and 21st. Five shows, by the way. We're doing live podcasts there Friday, Saturday. Live stand-up Friday, Saturday. Late Show and Reasonable Doubt for matinee on a Saturday. Why shouldn't I do three shows in one day? I'm not burning the calories I should be. I'm Your Emotional Support Animals out as we speak. Enjoy that book. And let's see. I want to say, I'm looking for all my people here. Ah, yeah. Alex Berenson and, of course, Dr. James Lindsay and Gina Grad and Bald Brian saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And grab Adam's book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Everything else at AdamCarolla.com.
Hey, movie lovers. Who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts, ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.